The First Verse, Chapter 1, Zamora, Nagawa Naikai. The wind had calmed at last. All through the night it had wailed, moaning through pine boughs, sweeping clean the crags, interrupting dreams of monks and nuns, with visions of roofs blown off to leave them in their meditations beneath open sky. Only with daybreak did the wind dissipate. Nagawa's monastery stood fast. The master Kumamoto sat in a small corner office, attending to his post-breakfast administrative duties. Before him were stacks of files and papers. Because these duties weighed on him more than any others, Kumamoto addressed them before the more important functions of the day.
Leave the way to the way.
Words of Kumamoto's master had become his own, his mantra for acceptance as he worked with columns of numbers. Three raps sounded at the closed door.
Hi?
The door slid open a few inches. A monk's head appeared.
Our five monks have returned from Chendo.
Kumamoto inhaled, then expelled air in a long, gentle out-breath. He looked into the monk's eyes. Their shared gaze was as deep as the master's inhalation. Kumamoto's mouth curved just a little, like a willow branch in the wind.
I will await their presence in the hall.
They have brought others, females. The master's mouth straightened. It was the only change in his countenance, even though the announcement held potential to cause a number of concerns.
How many?
Three young orphans.
I will see them all.
All five monks came before Master Kumamoto, where he was seated on the platform. One of them stepped forward and delivered a long tale about their journey from the day they had left his presence at the gates of their Nagawa monastery. The government of Chendo had considered their request and allowed their visit to a Chendese monastery of their own tradition that had survived decades of unrest. It was a rare event, one that brought with it immeasurable uncertainty. Naikai, their island nation, had a history of warfare with Chendo, the vast country across the sea. In time, the senior monk told of their later visit to an orphanage in the region of the monastery. He emphasized the formality of their tour in his narrative. Chendis had reasons of their own for presenting to Nikonese visitors a fine impression of how they cared for their unfortunate masses, although these reasons were difficult to comprehend. Chendi's attitudes were mysterious to their neighbors, those beyond distant boundaries, marked by ranges and rivers as well as beyond their shores. The Chendis had treated the monks to an elaborate banquet. Afterward, they were shown portions of facilities that had no doubt been prepared with them in mind. Many thousands of orphans were housed there. They visited an enormous playground where children interacted in an almost ritualistic form of play, children who may have been coached well, but so many. None of them plump. The monks felt the sorrow of 10,000 haiku. And then a series of events ruptured the formality of their tour. One monk hung back as they moved through the playground. Their hosts missed this at first, but soon paused and waited for him, yet not before he had spotted characteristic eyes of three youngsters who played a game with pebbles on the ground, apart from the others. Eyes of Nikonese. eyes that watched the strangers across the vastness of their unknowing, yet with some instinctual recognition, especially the eldest. She dropped the pebble she held, but did not drop her gaze. Silence had befallen all in the tour party as the lingering monk approached their hosts. He requested to know something about their Nikonese charges. One of the Chundese guides left to search for records. The rest continued on their way until they reached a pavilion near an entrance to the playground. All took seats where they could look out upon rolling hills, barren of trees, a faint glimmer of river showing in the distance. A woman in uniform came back in the guide's company with three sheaves of paperwork. She encountered language difficulties and handed the records to one of the administrators, who gave terse descriptions of how the little girls had been admitted and what was known of their pasts. Each were daughters of visitors to Chendo who had perished in the Satsuma uprising almost 4 years before. Their parents were unfortunate to have been in the plaza during the incident. The children were fortunate to have been left behind at their hotels and to have been taken in hand by hotel management, who subsequently sent the girls to the orphanage. Master Kumamoto listened to the account of all that occurred then, including a summary of complex negotiations that led to the monks' return with the three girls to their home country. Kumamoto signaled the children to come forward from where they sat on the floor at one side of the doorway. Two girls each held the little one by hand. Three waifs in threadbare dresses came abreast of the monks. Kumamoto contemplated them. Then they saw a lift at each corner of his mouth while his eyes mirrored his subtle greeting.
"We are honored to offer a home for you," he began. "A nunnery is annexed to our monastery where you may stay for a time until your way becomes clear to you and to us. We are simple people, together here because we devote ourselves to practice of Zazen according to teachings passed on to us by those who have gone before. Do you know what Zazen is?"
Two heads moved slowly from side to side. The smallest one just stared at him, her eyes wide set and deep.
"Teachings of Zazen offer means for awakening from the sleep in which most people dream, though they think their dreams are real. You may appreciate learning about this. Life here may not be much easier for you than it was in Chendo. We have little. We depend upon the charity of those who live in our region and upon whatever we are able to grow in the fields. We live an austere life. Our monastery is on this isle of Nagawa, because it is not as popular with tourists and has only villages, not cities, as are found on the main Nikonese islands. There are fewer distractions on Nagawa. So, let us meet one another."
Master Kumamoto beckoned to the eldest girl. She came before him, where they spoke to each other with soft voices. He joined his palms in a gesture of honor to her. He indicated she should return to the others and signaled for the next child to come up. When he came to the little one, the master met with a sense of desolation. She did not step forward at his signal. It was only after a push from the eldest that she finally did so. As Kumamoto's vision locked with the child's, he received a jolt of despair from her that cut through him. the predicament of all of Zamora appeared to be borne by this one. Tears formed in his heart. He met the intensity of her plight with all the compassion and outpouring of love developed through his training. His face became alight, the upturned corners of his mouth expanding from a mere gesture of a smile to a beam of warmth that revealed a small dimple. He leaned forward.
"What is your name?"
She wouldn't respond to him at first. He waited. She took a deep breath, little realizing that she mirrored his own way of doing so. 1203. She said this twice, first in Chinese and then more hesitantly in Nyquanese.
"What name were you born with?"
"I do not know. It has gone away." The master pondered. Her gaze had become downcast. As silence lengthened, she lifted her eyes to meet his. They shone with shame.
"Now you have a name. It has come from the bright pearl deep inside your heart. You are Tashami Roku. Say your name and take it with you. Set aside 12003, Tashami Roku."
Master Kumamoto joined his palms before him with a slight bow. She abandoned her gleaming smile, a flash that accompanied her whisper of her new name. She brought her palms together and bowed toward the master. Tashami Roku was the only one of the three to have done so.